We have an SOS announcement, meaning saving our seats. If anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, let's make saving our seats a spiritual foundation too. If you arrive early, please just save a seat for yourself and one other. The exception would be a saved seat due to a service commitment. If someone sits in your usual seat before you get there, be kind and let it go. First come, first seat. 5 minutes before the meeting begins, any saved seat should not occupied should be relinquished. Thank you. My name is Yangara, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA, and since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Dustina and Kobe, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Harrison will read the preamble.
Good evening. My name is Harrison. I'm an alcoholic. AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And Stacy H. will read the steps.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Stacy. Oh, thanks. Great. The 12 steps. 1. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable. 2. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could relieve us, could restore us to sanity. 3. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. 4. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7. Humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9. Made direct amends to such persons wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation, bless you, to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Jason will read the traditions.
Thanks. Hi, everyone. My name's Jason, and I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. First tradition, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Second tradition, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. The third tradition, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Fourth tradition, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Fifth tradition, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Sixth tradition, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seventh tradition, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eighth tradition, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Ninth tradition, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible for those they serve. 10th tradition, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11th tradition, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12th tradition, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Nancy O.
Hi, everyone. I'm Nancy. I'm an alcoholic. And I had a high bottom once. I came into AA when I was 24 years old. I didn't have any legal ramifications. I didn't have any children. I didn't really have a whole lot of wreckage. I had a lot of pain. I had a lot of relationships. And I was blessed because I got this. And God blessed me with 5 years of sobriety. And during that time, my life got good. You know, I got things. I got people back. And, you know, I could give you 100 reasons why I didn't stick around, but the long and the short of it is I stopped working 10, 11, and 12. You know, I got involved with a married man, and, you know, the book says that if our sexual behavior is selfish and we continue to harm others, we will drink. We are not theorizing. These are facts. And what happened was this was going to be a fling. You know, I hear a lot of beginners talk about casual sex and sobriety, and it's an oxymoron. There was nothing casual about it for me. What happened was I got pregnant, and if I hadn't been selfish enough prior to that, once I became pregnant, then it was all about me. And it's almost like going through the steps in reverse, because I began to get angry, indignant, and, you know, self-will run riot, and insanity returned, and I picked up that first drink. And when I picked it up, I swore I was going back to AA the next day. I did. You know, I was just going to drink, and I'll go back to AA, and I'll start counting days again. That was February 29th, 1996, and my sobriety date is 5/25/05. My home group is Garden City, and I did my fifth step this morning, and I made my first amends this afternoon. So, how does... this time, I surrendered in shackles. I was 6.5 months pregnant with my fourth child, facing 7 years in prison. And I couldn't get sober. I mean, I kept on coming back around, and I would sit in meetings and just think about leaving here to go get a drink. And I would, you know, and I just kept thinking that I was going to be able to get away with it one more time. And you know, one more time turned into losing my children, losing my law license. Just, you know, nobody wanted to talk to me anymore, and I didn't want to talk to anybody. In the end, I had this huge apartment in Long Beach, and I never went to the beach. I never left the apartment, except to go to the liquor store or to buy beer, hiding my 6.5-month pregnant belly. And every day I would wake up and I would say, God, no, it's not today. I'm not going to drink today. I'm going to go to the 7 o'clock meeting, and I'll be all right, you know. And around noon, I would say, well, I'm just going to have one. But I'll still go to the meeting, you know. And by 7 o'clock, it was oblivion, you know. I'm sure you could all imagine. But what happened was I ended up going out, drinking and driving, and was arrested for my third DWI. It was actually my fifth arrest, but my third criminal conviction. And when I got to up in front of the judge and he, you know, ordered bail, I think it was $40,000, and I knew I wasn't going home. And I walked down, back down to my cell in my shackles, and I sat down, and you know what I felt? Relief. It was over, you know? I wasn't going to hurt the baby anymore. And that's what it had to be in order for me to stay away from that first drink. I just remember thinking, at least, if nothing else, I know I can't get my hands on another one. And when I think back to that cell now, you know, it was a cell. But when I envision it, I see a window, you know, because there was a window for me. It was the path to freedom. And what I went, when I got over to the Nassau County Jail, I abandoned myself utterly to God because I had no choice. I mean, you know, but I did. And I really, really found a connection to my higher power, mostly because I was powerless over absolutely everything, even when I went to the bathroom, you know, and not knowing what I was going to what was going to happen. I had 4 children. By the way, the guy that he's still drinking. His wife, his first wife, has custody of our children, and I'm sober almost 21 months now, and my children live around the corner from me. I do have them back in my life. But at that time, when I was in jail, I really didn't have any contact with my 2 oldest children. My third child had been removed by ACS, and she was in Virginia with her grandmother. And I was pregnant with a baby who I did not know whether I was going to have to give into foster care when I gave birth. So I prayed so hard. I was like, God, anything, you know, I'll do your will, anything, but just don't let me have this baby in jail. And I had the baby in jail. But you know, I had to go right down. I don't know if God tests our faith. You know, I don't know, but I do know that my faith grew stronger then, and that it's pretty unshakable today. I had the baby, and I was in the hospital. I had a C-section, so they let me keep the baby, and then they came to me in the third day, and they said, where's the baby going? Because you're going back to jail. And I was like, now, it was a D felony, and it was for D reason. In Nassau County, they're quite serious about that, as they should be. And, you know, my lawyer was like, they really don't want to give you a program. I mean, Lord knows you've had enough chances. And I went back to court, and the judge did give me a program, and I went to a mother and child program. I reunited with my son. He was 5 days old. And we went to a program on Ward's Island, and it's a TC, which is a therapeutic community, and there isn't a whole lot of 12 steps there, but I had my book with me, and I had a prior concept, and I tried to work the program to the best of my ability, which can be summed up in 6 words: trust God, clean house, help others. And there were a lot of opportunities for service there because most of the people there had never had any contact with recovery whatsoever. So, you know, I tried to impart what I knew. But my real journey with the 12 steps kicked in when I started coming to the Atlantic Group. And I began to work with the book with Christine, and I kind of got stuck on step 2 because I was at a place that, like, I knew there was a God, but I just didn't really know how much he cared about me. And it took some time for me to really, really, totally grasp the third step. And I'm glad that, and I always felt like my sponsors were holding me back, Rob, and they were like, you're not there yet. And I was like, come on, I turned my life over in jail and I just want to get going here. And, they made me stay back. And when I look back now, like, I don't know that I really was turning my life over, but I do know that I give my thoughts and my actions to God today. I did get this program in jail, so I'm going to plug doing service at jails and institutions because, when people would come in and they would tell their stories, it gave me so much hope. And we may get here by the gift of desperation, but we stay by the gift of hope. And if anybody's struggling out there, my brother and sister came here for me tonight, and they just watched the demise to the point where I'm really quite sure they didn't think that I was going to get this again. But if you're struggling, you can get this again. Just give yourself one more day, and just know that you can get this, and just continue to pray even if you don't believe that anybody is listening. My life today, I live around the corner from my two oldest children. I see them on almost every other day basis. My baby has never been separated from me since that day. And in December, they gave me back my daughter. So when I was in jail, I was praying, God, just give me my kids back. That's all I want. I just want my kids. I want my kids under one roof. And this Christmas, I had my four children together with me. And I think that if God could accomplish that in 18 months, and believe me, that was the only thing I wanted, going out 30, 40 years, that's all I wanted. And, in 18 months, he gave me the gift of my heart, and I just can't imagine what he has in store for me to come. Thanks.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Charlie P.
My name is Charlie Panoff. I'm an alcoholic. I'm staring at that water for the last 12 minutes. Okay. My home group is the Atlanta Group. My sponsor's name is Vince. My sobriety date is 10/5/02, and I'm currently reworking steps 3 and 4 and living happily in 10, 11, and 12 most days. Let's see what it was like. First, it was really good. When I first took that drink of Stoli pepper-flavored vodka that looked like it was really old because it had Russian on the label, and for some reason I associate Russia with, older than me. I really liked it. I was like 13 years old, and I hated the taste of vodka, and I hated the taste of pepper, but I really liked that warm feeling that got in my chest, the fact that something different was going on in my head, that I was able to forget about whatever was going on with my friends, my family, with schoolwork, with anything. And that feeling stuck with me, and I kept chasing that feeling a lot, and I used a lot of other things to chase it, but everything started and everything ended with liquor. I know when I first got sober, I told people that I didn't really have a problem with liquor, but the reality of it is the only reason I drank is because I liked the effect produced by alcohol. And I used a lot of other things to try to find that same effect, and none of them worked as well, and that's why I'm here in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I grew up on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, about 26 blocks north of here, all the way on East End Avenue, which, for those of you who don't know where that is, if you think First Avenue is far from here, go two long blocks further. And that's why I thought I was different from everyone else, because I lived away from all my friends. Who knew that it was alcoholism the whole time? So I used to complain a lot to my parents, who were constantly fighting. First they loved each other, then they hated each other, then they didn't talk to each other, then they became friends only when it had to do with me, and now for some reason they're friends again. My dad comes up and visits. He lives in Charlotte now, and he stays at my mother's apartment. This is a concept that's completely foreign to me based on some of the stuff that I saw when I was younger, but I think a lot of it has to do with the heartache that I put them through throughout my childhood. Even before I knew what liquor was, I was constantly getting in trouble because I always wanted attention. I always wanted people to look at me. That's part of the reason why I'm wearing a pink bow tie right now. Because even though I have 410 people looking at me right now, today in the office I had another 20 extra people looking at me based solely on the bow tie. I quickly found out when I got sober that alcohol was not my problem, that I was my problem. I originally went away to rehab because I owed people money, because I would take things that I thought belonged to me, which in essence belonged to them, that happened to be illegal, and I thought they were going to come hurt me over it. And I told my mother that I wanted to go to rehab and that I had a problem because I knew she thought I had a problem, and I knew she was not sending me to Miami on vacation, and the only way to get out of town was to go away for 28 days. And I thought it was going to be like the movies. I'd go, I'd sing Kumbaya, I'd hug a couple of people, and I'd come home and everything would have blown over. But I wanted to prove to myself before I left that I didn't have a problem. And little did I know that was one of the first tests. Well, I was testing myself the way the books suggest we do, and I tried a little controlled drinking. I told myself I was going to go out and I was going to have only one beer, or I was going to go out and I wasn't going to get drunk tonight. And I did really well for like 2 days. I stayed in my room, basically, didn't talk to anyone, slept a lot, and didn't get drunk. Day after that, I was off to the races again. And the night before I left for rehab, I told myself, maybe I have a problem. And I decided to do whatever these people told me to do. These people meaning the people who did this for a living and helping people get sober. I knew nothing about AA. Really, I knew nothing about getting sober. All I knew is that they knew more than I did. So I got there and I started doing what they told me to do until they told me that after 28 days, I needed to go to a halfway house. I said, no, I signed up for 28 days. I'm going home. This is over. And my parents gave me a really nice ultimatum. They said, you can go to the halfway house and we'll continue to pay for you. Or you can come home, get your clothes and leave. It's like, well, let's see. I got no job. I could probably get like the $7 and quarters they left me to do laundry in rehab and use that for food for about an hour because I'm a big guy and, you know, lunch costs like over 10 bucks for me. Or I go to this halfway house. And so I went to the halfway house. And without a doubt, it was the greatest decision I ever made because it introduced me to this program. Every day we got in a big purple van that on the back had teal writing that said clean and serene. If I wanted to traffic drugs, I was doing it in this van because nobody is pulling it over. I was just north of Scranton, Pennsylvania, in a town called Nicholson, where I'm pretty sure maybe one or two of you have heard of it, and you probably were in the same halfway house. For those of you who haven't heard of it, it consists of a general store that has pretty much water and expired milk in it, about 15 houses, 3 bars, and a strip club. Those 15 houses were in a trailer park and none of which had foundation. So here I am in a place that I never pictured myself, living in a log cabin where we had a wood-burning stove for heat in one of the coldest winters Pennsylvania's ever had. And I loved every minute of it. I got to learn how to cook. I cooked for everyone while I was there. And then I got this job working on a ski resort. It was a hill with snow on it. But when people ask me what I did, it was a ski resort. I even got snowed in the hospital in Carbondale, Pennsylvania on Christmas Day because I got hit in the head with a chairlift. That was fun. Anyway, I got back to the city after this little stint in the middle of nowhere, and I had absolutely no prospects for a job or a place to live. My father had moved to North Carolina while I was away for business and personal reasons, and I had his apartment for 5 weeks. In that time, I had to find a job, get acclimated to the city in terms of staying sober and finding meetings to go to on a regular basis, find a sponsor, find a new place to live, and my biggest concern was getting cable hooked up. I had no actual plan for living, even though I had been 4 months removed from alcohol. I quickly found this group. I was told that there were a lot of young people here. My excuse was AA isn't for me because there are no young people. I was 19 at the time, and that's really not the case. I look around here and I can see all of you. Not all of you can see each other, but there are a lot of young people in AA. And my excuse at a meeting when I raised my hand and shared was, there are no young people. I don't belong here. So, of course, the oldest woman in the room walked up to me afterwards and told me it was going to be all right and asked me for my phone number. It's like, come on. Okay, sure. A lot of people have asked me for my phone number since I got here. That's great. I doubt I'm ever going to hear from you again. Little did I know I was going to run into her at another meeting later that night. She introduced me to someone who had me come to this meeting, and I quickly got involved in getting a service commitment and working with a sponsor who started taking me through the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We call it the Big Book. If you want to look at for by title, it is called Alcoholics Anonymous, and it is where this program got its name from. In it is a design for living. There was no book out there to tell me how to put down the drink, but there is a book that can tell me how to stay living without it. And I'm pretty sure most of the people in this room haven't had a drink today. If you have, it's all right. Just don't drink tomorrow. Pick up the book. Start working with somebody, because believe me, there's language in there that you are not going to understand. It was written a long time ago by people you probably wouldn't have met had you been alive then, and you're not going to understand most of the stuff in it without somebody's help. That's why we get sponsors. I quickly went through the steps in a fashion that did me absolutely no good, because I didn't think I had to do all the work that you all had to do, because I didn't drink for as long as all of you, because I was only 19 years old. Some of you had had much worse bottoms than I did. Some of you had been drinking for 45 years. I was over twice my age. I didn't need to do all this work. So I kind of, you know, did a little here, did a little there, told myself I was doing it. And it did absolutely nothing until I sat down and I redid it, honestly, with somebody who didn't take any nonsense from me. Sorry, I almost let that one go, Peggy. Eventually, that stopped working for me because I stopped listening to them for a myriad of reasons. And I had to make a switch to another person who is showing me things that I never found in that book before. And now I've read it maybe 5 or 6 times all the way through, cover to cover. I've been to countless big book studies. I've been through it with multiple sponsees. I've been through it with at least 2 sponsors in its entirety already. And I'm still learning things in that book. So if I can help anyone in this room tonight, which I hope I have, you can repay me by giving me some ice for my messed up ankle afterwards. I had to throw a plug in there for sympathy, because we all know it's about me tonight with my pink bow tie. If I've helped anyone here, please take away from this. Take anyone's number in this room. Find out who their sponsor is, if they're working the program of recovery that's in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and ask that person to take you through it with them. Do the work in the book, and I guarantee you your life will get better. Thanks.
Our main speaker tonight is Irene.
Hi, my name is Irene, and I'm an alcoholic. Irene. Very powerful meeting. I love all the beginners. God bless you, and keep coming back. It's wonderful. It's a wonderful ride. My name is Irene. I'm an alcoholic. My anniversary is August 29th. 1988. My sponsor is Eileen H. My home group is Hell's Kitchen, because I'm a Hell's Kitchen gal. I got to get them things out of the way. I'm really nervous. I'm always nervous, and that's one of the reasons why I drank. I really wanted to come here tonight, you know, really dressed the opposite than I was supposed to. I really, really wanted to come in hot pants, pasties, and high-top sneakers. Because I'm an alcoholic. When you tell me I'm to do something, I have to do the opposite. And I still didn't get dressed corporate. I had a suit on at work today. You know, it's just who I am. I'm an alcoholic and a drunk. A drunk. From 10th Avenue. And I loved every minute of it in the beginning. I was 12 years old when I started drinking. The old Madison Square Garden was there. So many young people, you won't even know where that was. But anyway, they used to have rodeos then, and the circus. And there was lots of cowboys and clowns, and I loved every one of them. You know, and of course I got a little older, and then I really loved every one of them. And you know how that happened? I found Ballantine Ale. You know, I became very beautiful. There was a wonderful powder room in this Belvedere Hotel across from the garden. And you went down these velvet stairs, and they had this beautiful couch I laid on there. I smoked my father's cigarettes and drank Ballantine ale, and I got drunk, and everything seemed fine. I became pretty. I became tough, because that's what you had to be where I grew up on 9th Avenue, 48th Street. If I got beat up downstairs, I went upstairs and I got my ass kicked for not beating that person up, you know, that kid up. So that's kind of, you know, the way it went. But anyway, the drinking started then. It started blackouts immediately. One time I fell asleep in the powder room and I woke up. It was like 9 o'clock at night. I was like 13 years old. You know, so that's the story, that my drinking really took me to different places, you know, and it continued for 30 years. My family is, everybody's an alcoholic in my family, you know, they say it, you know, I'm not telling, you know, claiming their disease, but they say it themselves. God almighty, you know, I was on antabuse when I was out there, and I drank on it. Nobody wants to do that. It's awful. Why I'm alive and standing here tonight, it's God, not me, and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the nights I was out drinking, I had three children at the time. I was out drinking, and I was in a bar across the street. On 9th Avenue, you had 100 bars. On 8th, you had 106. You know, but I was in this bar, and I was in the ladies' room, and I came out from around a corner. And at that time, Pall Mall cigarettes was the longest cigarette you could smoke. As I turned the corner, that cigarette got shot right out of my mouth. And the sick part of this disease is I just held my lips and went, oh, and hopped up on the stool and said, you know something, give me a Scotch sour on the rocks, please. My lips are burning. You know, very sick, very sick. While I was doing this, there was still guns going off. You know, that's just one of the stories that why, you know, why I'm alive. You know, why am I here? I used to say that to myself on suicide attempts. Why? I can't even kill myself right. I'm not a good daughter. I'm not a good person. I'm not a good wife. I'm not a good mother. You know, and even the guy upstairs, he doesn't want no part of me. Because I, you know, 4 suicide attempts. I kept waking up in different hospitals. 4 so-called nervous breakdowns. You know, I timed them right. You know, and a lot of us will understand that, you know, when you commit suicide. Some of us, I think a lot of us, you know, want to look pretty. Especially us gals, you know. I would, you know, put on a negligee and put my eyebrows on because I had shaved my eyebrows off all my life. And I put on this brown pencil and false eyelashes. You know, I had platinum blonde hair. You know, and I'd have these flowers all over the bed, and I'd have all the, you know, the shades were falling off the windows. The kitchen hasn't been cleaned in 5 years, but I looked pretty sexy when I was going out. And I would wake up in a psych ward. I'd say, well, what am I doing here? But it was nice. It was nice because they didn't call it, you know, now you have rehabs and stuff. Used to ship you off to a psych ward. And I liked it because I didn't have to see the husband, the mother, the stepfather. You know, they're all giving you a hard time of why you drink. You know, and I would stay in there for 28 days and I would, you know, get a pass to go out. And one time I got a pass to go out and of course, where did I go? I went to a bar. But, you know, we are really good, you know, at people getting over on people, that my psychiatrist came to the bar. I got her drunk. You know, I mean, we are really, really smart, good people. You know, it was just insane, you know. My oldest son is 42. My youngest is 37. I went to AA before my 37-year-old was born. Because I was going with a guy 35 years older than me. He was a mob guy. He had money. He bought me beautiful jewelry, beautiful stuff, hot pants like I was going to come in tonight. You know, hot pants, boots, a beautiful fox coat, you know. And he told me I had a problem. He didn't drink before 10 o'clock at night, so he told me I had to go to AA. So I did. I went to the Times building on 43rd Street, and that night, you know, and they actually that night I was wearing hot pants and this coat with the blonde hair and the eyebrows and the eyelashes, and I came out in boots, and I came out of this place, and they did a sweep of that block, and I got arrested for prostitution. You know? They brought me to the 54th Street police station. I knew the detectives there. They thought it was very funny. And I was really PO'd. I told this guy that I will never go to AA. You get arrested for prostitution when you go to AA. So it took me another 20 years, I think. Anyway, I'll get to the end of the story because we all have our war stories. Jesus. We all have our war stories. You know, and I was thinking tonight, coming over, you know, and I haven't shared this. I'm going to share it and get it out of the way because you're as sick as your secrets. When I was about 16, I went to the Empire Hotel with a whole bunch of girls and stuff and did serious drinking, and I passed out, and I was raped that night. And I held that secret until tonight. And why it came up tonight and why I'm sharing, I don't know, but I know I got to get it out of the way. You know, I got to kill that fire there. That's too powerful. And I drank with this man after it, you know, and I thought to myself, well, this son of a gun is dead, and I can't even dig him up and smack him in the mouth, you know, or anything. But anyway, I preyed on that resentment from Lexington Avenue. I'll keep praying. Anyway, I'm going to get to the best part of the end of my, very end of my drinking. I worked as a waitress. I worked as a barmaid, but I knew I was an alcoholic, but I was a functioning alcoholic. So I thought, you know, I never drank behind the bar. So at night, like the last half hour, I would have a drink, and then it became earlier, earlier, and earlier, and then it was before I went on the bar. So I thought, you know, I got to be a waitress. I can't be a barmaid. So I've been waiting tables, like for 30 years I waited tables. And everybody met after work. I worked double shifts. That helped me not to drink. You know, if I worked 12 hours a day, I couldn't drink. I would open up the restaurant about 10:30. I'd take a 3 o'clock break, have a couple of drinks, go back at 4:30, and then close at 1, and then God knows what time I'd get home. If I got home on a Friday night, maybe I was still in my uniform on Sunday. You know, it was not a pretty picture. I had a nice, beautiful apartment, a four-bedroom apartment on the west side with a terrace and everything else. And my daughter was 16 years old, and I beat the living heck out of her because she went home with she went to this barmaid's boyfriend's apartment to get something, and he took her to the apartment. And I was mad because she didn't listen to me. You should know better than go to a man's apartment alone. So anyway, I was drunk. I beat her up very bad. And I went home that night, and I never went back. Did I think of stopping drinking? No. Did I think of leaving them four kids? No. I left them with the clothes I had on my back, and I left them with my ex-husband because I figured they'd be better off without me. Then my drinking really got bad, and that's where I was, like, sleeping in a hallway. That's where I was crawling from the bar around the corner on my hands and knees. That's when I wound up trying to kill myself again and waking up in Bellevue. And I don't know what happened. I don't know what happened the weekend that I went out drinking. It was a birthday party of one of the gals on the west side, and I went to this church affair, and I always made it, you know, I always thought I had best legs in town. I always thought I was the best dancer. I was on top of the tables dancing at this church, you know, fell off the table, slid under the table, lift up the tablecloth. Did anybody see me? You know, I mean, it's insane. But that was that weekend, and I was so sick. I was just so sick. I never knew if the first drink was going to get me drunk or if the 66th drink was going to get me drunk. And that weekend, I don't know what happened. I went home. I knew it was over. I knew it was over. I couldn't live. I couldn't die. I was not afraid of dying. I wanted to die. It was that in-between. Yeah, that hole in your soul. That feeling like crap of what you said before, you know, said the night before. Of really giving yourself a good look in the mirror, you know. I had no idea, you know. My godson at the time was 16 years old, and his dad was in the program. And matter of fact, in this very building, they used to call it Midtown, used to have a meeting downstairs. And Kenneth, I called Kenneth, and I said, Ken, the kid had told me when he made his communion and confirmation, listen, I'll take you to the meeting on the west side, Annie. Just call me Annie. And whenever you're ready. He was a young kid. So at 16, he was 16, I called him up and I said, you think you could take me to the east side to one of them meetings? Because I don't want anybody to see me over on the west side. So he did. And I came to Midtown, which was downstairs, and I thought this meeting was big. It seems it's about the same size. I was petrified. Petrified. And he knew everybody. And all these women were running over to me and giving me numbers in a big book. And I wanted, like, go away. Go away. I was shaking. My eyelashes were shaking. I was in such bad shape. But I looked great. I had on a Kelly green coat. I looked corporate that night. I thought you had to get dressed up to go on the east side. I look great. Fedora hat, Sally Jesse Raphael, glasses, red, blonde hair, Kelly green coat, taxi shoes, high heels. And I did this, went on the bus with the big book, and that time they didn't have the small edition, so I ripped it open, ripped it in half, because it was too big. I felt like I was carrying the Bible. Ripped it in half, then it was okay. I could not read for 2 years, but I carried the big book with me. What I heard that night was, drag your feet, your brain will follow. Because I really believed that I was getting wet brain. You know? And hope. I remember going to a meeting on the west side. In summertime. They had this big sign. It was like made out of felt, and it was a candle, a white candle on a red backing. And I thought, these people are really nuts. It's August, and they got Christmas signs up. But hope. But I remembered it said hope on the side. So that's what kept me coming. I had no idea. You know, I thought, these people are all clear-eyed and happy. I was so angry. So angry. But I kept coming. My journey has been wonderful. And let me tell you something. My life is not too good this year at all. This is a killer disease. I have a daughter out there that's homeless. And I have a son that just got out of Rikers. And I have another son in Pennsylvania that's in jail. It's a killer disease. It doesn't care, you know. So when you sit here and I see all these young people, my God, hold on to your seat. You're in for the ride of your life. When I came in, I had this sponsor, Karen, God rest her soul, she's dead. She was tough. She was tough. First, I had this woman that I wrapped around my little finger for the first 2 years. And then she said to me, I don't do this, I haven't done the steps, so you better get somebody else. I looked in the book and I thought, this woman's name sounds okay. Karen. A. Oh, man, she was tougher than me. How could that be? She was tough, but she was fabulous. I said to her one night, you know, I can't get this spirituality thing. So I had gone to churches, synagogues, you name it, retreats. What are they going, ashrams or whatever you call it, the monks. I did it all. I said, you know, Karen, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to Rome. She said, good, I'm coming with you. I went. We went. Never been off 9th and 10th Avenue. I went to Rome. I wanted to talk to the Pope. I was 5 years, and she said, good, you'll get an audience, that's for sure. I thought she meant, you know. So anyway, we get back 10 days later, and she said, did you find that spirituality? I said, you know something? It's in here. It's in here. It's in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's in here now. I don't know how it got there, but it's in here. Oh, she said, keep coming back. I also went back to school. I also learned out that I wasn't stupid, because I was told all my life I was stupid. I learned that I had a learning disability, and it was wonderful to learn that. I was so happy to find out I had a learning disability. I went home, I was excited. I said to my other half, I have a learning disability. He looked at me, he said, you're just finding that out. I was happy because I thought I was stupid, you know, and I went back to school, and I went out of being a waitress and a barmaid, and I'm in the corporate world. I was in real estate. This program has really given me so much, you know. God, there's so many things. There's so many wonderful things. I had to take custody of my grandchildren a week before Christmas years ago. And I thought, how am I going to do this? I don't have any money. I don't know how I'm going to do this. How am I going to pull this Christmas off? Well, I tell you, I was talking like this at a meeting. Christmas Eve, I had a tree. I had decorations. The kids had toys. They had clothes. They had everything. And I had people, food, and everybody was there. And we went to midnight mass. We went to a meeting. You know, that's just one of the many, many things. Another time, two of my children were hurt very seriously, and I had to. And as a matter of fact, it was my daughter, and we thought we were going to lose her that night. And I called my sponsor, and again, people came down to the hospital and stayed with me. You know, when I stopped drinking, and I drank in the same bar for over 30 years, I have not heard from one person. Not one person. You know? I'm very proud to be an alcoholic. I never thought that I would say that. But I found a way to live. And you taught me that. And I didn't have to do it alone. You know? I put my hand in yours, and you put your hand in mine, and we did it together. You know, we did it all together. We all got sober. We're sitting here in an AA room tonight. It's cold. You know where I would be? I would still be in the bar from last night, because it was cold last night. You know? And then I may wind up in Pennsylvania, because they may have a fireplace there. You know? But we're here. You know, at Christ Church at an AA meeting, and we have a full house. How lucky can we get? You know? I have 10 grandchildren. They have never seen me drunk. What a gift. What a gift. My kids got big mouths, they got to tell them. And my oldest grandson, who's in college, his third year of college, he said, they lie, Nanny. I said, you're right. He knows. He knows. You know, but that's my story. I do the steps. I have sponsees that I love. I have a wonderful sponsor today. I have to talk about Peggy, my friend Peggy, who died this year. And she would always say to me when I was going to get up speaking, and I thought of her tonight, because she'd say, talk about your drinking. You know, so keep her in your prayers. And I thank you for my sobriety.